Welcome to the Manuscript Academy podcast,
brought to you by
a writer
and an agent
who both believe that education is key.
The beauty is the people you meet along the way,
and that community makes all the difference.
Here at the Manuscript Academy, you can learn the skills, make the connections, and have access to experts all from home.
I'm Julie Kingsley.
And I'm Jessica Sinsheimer.
Put down your pens, pause your word counts, and enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Today, we had a really fun episode with yet another as yet unnamed award winner. Allie McLafferty was incredible. She is a high school teacher who heard that she won one of our awards. Melissa Edwards, agent at Stone Song Literary, chose her at the latest panel, and she did a happy dance in front of her students who are still, I believe, cheering her on. I'm really excited about this episode. We are still working on what to call these awards. We have thought about it as the Hall of Fame. We've thought about it as the Manuscript, in parentheses, Academy Awards. We might get sued. We'll work on that. If you happen to have a name for what we can call these amazing writers that agents are choosing at panels so they can put it in the bios of their query letters, we are all ears. Just send us an email at academy@manuscriptwishlist.com.
And if you're interested in this and how it works, when we do our panels, we are having the featured agent choose their favorite of the night. And it's just another way that you can get some recognition, that you can know that your work is working in a positive way. So we're just really hoping to make people happy, to give people that boost they need to keep working in this tough submission world.
Yeah, and we keep getting emails from agents and editors who apparently are listening. So, hey, we figured this might be a way to get them in front of agents and editors. If you are ever interested in one of these guests, just send us an email, academy@manuscriptwishlist.com, and we'll be happy to put you in touch. All right, on with the show.
You guys, we have one of our award winners from one of our panels here, Allison McLafferty. We're so excited to have you. We're going to talk about your publishing journey and review your first page inquiry. I'm so excited.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. This is very cool for me.
And Allie, you told us a cute story about what happened when you heard that you won. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. So I had just been teaching a class on the 1950s, and I was trying to get across this juxtaposition of an excitement after World War II and a sort of economic golden age alongside this sort of existential dread of nuclear annihilation. So we were like delving very deeply into the psyche of the 1950s. And when I teach, I get like I sort of run around and I get very energetic. And then the class was done and everyone's packing up and some people are leaving. And a student asked me a question. So I went onto my computer and the email came in and I shouldn't have clicked it, right? I should have been much more professional. Like, I will do this after I ask your question, 11th grader, but I didn't. So I opened it and I went, oh my God, oh my God. My student was like, is everything okay? Probably thinking that I was, you know, still talking about the 50s. And I said, oh, I submitted some of my writing and I just was told that I get to meet with these well-known agents and they liked my work. Oh my God, oh my God. And my students were like, yeah. And so they held up my hands. And I like did a little happy dance and then they high-fived me and it was, you know.
I'm actually so glad you had that moment with the students. They should know that, you know, like you're doing hard things too. I think it's really important.
I think that they submit so much of their writing to me and they're always like, oh God, what is she going to think about my writing? And so they know that like, I have those same feelings, you know? And so that was exciting for me and amusing for them.
So tell us about your writing journey so far. Have you sent your work out? How long have you been working on this? Tell us more.
So this is the second book. I worked in a middle grade fiction that was written during the pandemic as a sort of, oh God, what's happening to the world? I'm going to feel cozy by writing this. And it was a bit, it was fine, but it was, I don't really know middle grade. But I learned the publishing process and the whole querying journey that way. And so for this book, it was written very much from a more personal place because I teach in Texas. And as I sort of explain in my query, there's a lot of a sense that I get that we're very much being buffeted by the headwinds of the culture war. And I'm sort of one of the main teachers on campus that is there for the students to discuss issues, especially surrounding gender, our LGBTQ plus community, our female identifying students, our male identifying students as well. But like it's the class that I teach, which was the school's first gender studies class, tends, as is often the case in universities, to be more populated by female identifying students as well as our student queer community. So I've taught this class for a long time. It's become like very important to many of the students. And especially living in Texas for these past few years, where I'm sure you're aware in the news, you know, a lot of anti-trans bills and banning of drag shows in public spaces or in your schools, you know, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, a lot of these things have been really deeply hitting my students. And so we've been discussing this a lot in classes. So the book was grown out of these very personal issues that I was discussing in great depth with my students and having their own perspectives as young people growing up in the country. And so I felt very much a drive to write this book that touches on a lot of these kind of facets, even though it's done in like a fantasy setting, right? So it's one of those uses of fantasy as, okay, how are we going to delve into issues that feel similar to what we're going through? So I wrote it last winter into spring, you know, and then I have a friend who was an agent and a friend who is an active writer, and they read it. They really enjoyed it. And so worked on my query, sent the query out in a batch, nothing back. And I was like, all right, I really hate query writing so much. So sent it to Query Shark. She really helped me. Have sent it out to a couple agents, but I am struggling quite a bit with the genre. And so I kind of was like so thankful for the opportunity to sort of speak about it with you. It just wasn't written as like, I'm going to write in this specific genre and this specific style, right? It was very much written in response to feelings among students. And so I'm like, well, where the heck was I writing this to be placed, essentially?
Wow. Okay, so how many queries have you sent out?
I think the old version, 16. The new version, 15, I think.
Okay, yeah. And when and what have the responses been?
So the first batch was no, was mostly from rejections. And I was like, I think I need to change the query. And then the second batch was in the middle of January, actually. And I have gotten back only three responses. So I'm still waiting on some of those.
Yeah. Well, I'm just curious, do you know what was wrong with the first batch? Because when you're talking about your work, I was just like, you know, I'm a former teacher too. And I'm like, yes, 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 yes. Yes, yes, yes. You know, like it has all the things that I think it's important, you know. So obviously the heart of your book has something really important for students and for the greater population. And coming from the Texas perspective within that, I think is even more interesting in knowing what those kids are going through. So it sounds so great. What was wrong with that first batch? What changes did you make?
So the problem with the first batch is that I don't think that I presented it very well in terms of what it was trying to do. So in the first batch, I was writing it. First of all, it was originally pitched as YA sci-fi, but it's not really sci-fi because there's a lot of uniquely imagined species, but there's no spaceships and stuff. So I think that was a little bit misleading. And then the other thing is that one of the aspects of this culture that I write about is that it's a complicated culture because there are restrictions, very strong restrictions on women and on female expression. And I think I tried to focus too much on that, right? And then I kind of focused more on like the way that this was discussing imperialism, which is not exactly accurate, right?
Well, it sounds like you spiraled away from your core story, trying to shove in the world.
Yes, I think it was too much. Let me show you this cool culture. And I think I was trying to be like too smart, if that makes sense, you know, look at the interesting issues that my stuff goes into and not just being like, hey, here is the story. And then when I went on to Manuscript Academy and there was this great little video thing on it, I basically had a pitch, right? And this idea of, there was an interesting video on like high concept novels of, hey, can you just basically say, this is this distilled? And it was one of the women who were like, well, some people are going to say, oh, it's just too complex and try to see if you can get it down. And that was very helpful to me because I was like, oh, I think I've created just too much here and I got to distill it. So whether or not the second query has been successful, I don't know because I'm still waiting to hear responses. But I felt more confident that it accurately represented what I'm trying to do. And yet the limitations of the query letter make it so that I'm sacrificing world building for talking about the stakes. I don't know. So I'm still struggling a little bit with that.
Well, that's actually really common. A lot of people who are writing in a genre that requires you to create a world pitch it world first because they're like, what's unique about the story? My world. So here's, you know, three paragraphs about the world, one line about the characters and what they want. And I can see the temptation there, though. You want to show people this amazing thing that you've created and what's different about it. But I think ultimately what makes us want to read more than the query is for character, usually. its character and what they want and why they can't have it. And, you know, even if they're in a completely different world from ours, or one like yours with a lot of similarities, I think it's ultimately the things that we can relate to that make us want to read more.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
I'm dying to dig in. Can we dig in? Can we dig into these query and first pages?
Yeah. Will you share your screen and read them for us?
Okay. I read on manuscript wishlist that you're interested in such and such. Daughters Rising is a YA fantasy take on West Side Story with a feminist twist. When the two warring patriarchies collapse, the women take over. 17-year-old Sarah didn't plan to kiss Tash. In fact, she should have killed him. Tash is an Imperial, one of a brutal invading species who conquered Sarah's people, the Heshti. Tash's people are the reason Sarah is crushed between two patriarchies. Imperial men own and abuse her land, Heshtia. Heshti men own and abuse their women. Until now, Sarah has only always obeyed and submitted. But when Tash saves her life in a bombing by Heshti revolutionaries, she meets him secretly to learn why. The reason is as simple as it is shocking. He too feels caged by his own culture. He too dreams of escape. A new hunger awakens in her, not just for Tash's soft lips, but for the shocking secrets he tells her about both their peoples. Everything Heshti men have hidden from Heshti women about an immense power concealed within them. But Heshti and Imperial men are planning an epic final battle for control of Heshtia. Heshti men expect her to stay and fight for her people's freedom. Tash expects her to flee with him. Yet neither choice frees Heshti women. For that, Sarah will have to gather Heshti women, tell them all she's learned, and shatter the world as she knows it in a matriarchal revolution. She'll need to decide if she has the courage and ruthlessness to abandon all men, her rulers, her friends, her family, and Tash. Daughters Rising, at 103,000 words, is a YA fantasy that uses uniquely imagined fantasy species and civilizations to question gender norms and identities. It will appeal to fans of the romance, gendered themes, and mix of fantasy and science in Amy Kaufman and Megan Spooner's The Other Side of the Sky duology, Dana Swift's Cast in Firelight, and Jiren J. Zhao, I'm very sorry if I mispronounced that, Iron Widow. I am a high school teacher with a PhD in history from UC Berkeley, where my focus was on race and gender studies. I now work at a high school in Texas, where my gender studies seminar was the first of its kind. The conversations I had with students in that class over the years won me the Teacher of the Year Award and inspired this novel. When not writing or leaping excitedly about the classroom, I like to garden, mountain bike, and peruse antique fairs to decorate my home and classroom like cozy little time machines.
I just got the chills.
I love it.
You know, I wish I had some feedback for you. And maybe Jessica does, but I do not. I just enjoyed it. And I especially enjoyed how you took a line, you know, every once in a while to really like entash, you know, and just set it there. You had the guts to set it there and really hold on that space. We don't see that often. I think it works really well here.
Yeah, you don't follow the exact format
that
people usually suggest, but that's okay. You don't have to. The thing is, you're allowed to break the rules if you do it well, and you do. And I agree that Antash is really powerful because you set up a situation where, and by the way, you do a remarkably clear, thorough, yet concise
efficient
job of explaining how all of this works, what these different groups want. I love the idea that there's this hidden power in women, that this group is hidden from them. I love that you almost play with the idea that a lot of people have had as a thought experiment, what if all the men die tomorrow? But you've given your character like a new way to experience them right before this could happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that is such a perfect emotional counterpoint there. Well done.
Right. And also, yeah, it shows you're the person to, I mean, your bio, I think, is so well done because it shows that you are the person that understands this. You're there, that you are with the kids, that you have your finger on the pulse of this situation in our country right now. And I think that heightens it even more.
Yeah, that you have the education from UC Berkeley, which we think of as very liberal. And then to go to Texas where things are quite different, you've seen it from both perspectives. So I think that's really valuable. Plus, it makes me picture what you were like at your Teacher of the Year ceremony.
No,
I bet you
right?
were dancing then, too.
It's like the thing I'm most proud of in the whole world.
I mean, my children, I love that so much.
Are also great, but I was really pleased with that.
Yeah. So let's just go back to this line. 17-year-old Sarah didn't plan to kiss Tash. In fact, she should have killed him. Tash is an Imperial, one of the brutal invading species who conquered Sarah's people, the Heshti. I love how you started with a kiss here. Instead of the, like, it all started with a kiss, right? And it's such a simple thing that a 17-year-old would do. And it changed everything. And I think that shows a lot of who she is, right? She is someone that's going to take a risk. She is a little impulsive. Like, we know some simple things about her from that very simple line.
Okay, so talk to us about your first version. How did you go about this? What kind of resources did you find? And yeah, what was your thinking of, I have to do blank for version one?
So I think that my first draft came from a place, I don't want to say of arrogance, but like potentially misplaced confidence, in that the story felt, it poured out of me in a way my first book hadn't. And it felt like I had a visceral need to write it. I felt close to it. And so I thought the query letter would just be easy to write. You know, I was like, I feel like I know exactly what I'm trying to say here. So I wrote it and I was like, yep, this is definitely my book. And now that I'm reading it, especially with some steps away from my book, if I'm an agent, I'm like, there's a lot going on and I'm not sure what it is. But my process was, I was writing it in the summary that I sort of had in my brain. And I also did hear, basically, I summarized the first chapter. And I'm realizing that doesn't do a very good job of talking about the full arc of the story. And it actually limits it in a lot of ways. But I believe that I read somewhere, I was looking up, you know, what are successful query letters? And someone said basically that the first chapter of Ancillary Justice was the query letter, right? That the query doesn't have to say the whole story. It could even just talk about your first chapter. And I think I was like, oh, great. So easy. But reflecting upon that, it worked very well for Ancillary Justice. It doesn't seem to particularly work well for mine.
Well, that's so interesting because in a sense, you are very zoomed in to just talking about one small narrative arc, but you're very zoomed out emotionally and on a sensory level. So it's almost like we're hovering above the characters in terms of how they feel, what they think, what everything looks like, you know, what people care about, what they're worried about. And you're really zoomed in on that plot point, which is interesting. And I actually think the opposite is usually more effective when you're really zoomed in on how everyone feels and kind of zoomed out a little bit so that we can see like the bigger goals of the work, what the work itself wants. That's so interesting. And I'm trying to think how, I guess it is possible to pitch a book where the focus is on the first chapter, but I wouldn't generally recommend it.
I knew you were going to say that because I can read your mind now, Jessica.
Over Zoom or in general?
For my superpower, I was like, I know what she's going to say, but this one.
I like to say that it's usually a good idea to start with the reader on the shore, grab their hand, and then slowly pull them into your world, which is what you do. But yeah, it's interesting.
I know if you're a longtime listener, you've heard this, but it's like the rendering of story. They're like getting the fat out. Like what needs to be there in that perfect bite of bacon?
That's interesting because when you talk about rendering, you're talking about cooking and cooking extra stuff out. When I think about rendering, I think about it like rendering an image where you're adding the structure to it. So I guess
I think of it as like bacon fat's delicious, right? But like you just take it out and you can use it somewhere else. And once we're in your story, we're like, oh my gosh, look at all the things in the story. But it's almost like it's too much for one page when we're just trying to take it in.
Yeah, I can definitely see that now.
What editorial advice, like what specifically got you from the first version to the second version? Was it hearing that you needed to zoom in more? Was it hearing that you needed to zoom out in terms of plot? What was it that made that happen?
So before I sent to Query Shark, I had my readers, right, who were the person that was previously an agent and the author. They were like, wait, this is not your book. And I was like, obviously it is. I wrote it.
Right.
And so my good friend, shout out Victoria, said, it was either Victoria or Sarah. Maybe it was shout out Sarah, said, start with a kiss. You know, like, how about she kissed Tash and well, she shouldn't have done that, right? But that actually happens quite a bit later in the book. But that's that moment, right? Like, basically, that's the crisis moment where then things are unfolding very quickly. And my first reaction was, well, I can't possibly do that because that's not setting up how she meets him and everything else. But then I wrote it and my other friend, because they're both working on this together with me because they're wonderful, amazing friends. And my other friend said, oh, I like that. So that was very useful for me, was to know, start with essentially like when things begin happening rather than like this setup. And so then I started pairing that, but I still kept putting too much of basically chapter one in, right? And then that's why I was like, oh, I feel really stuck. I think I need an agent's help, which is sort of like, I work very closely with my students, right? Anytime they're having difficulty, I'm like, let's meet and go over every single paragraph. And I never write it for them, but I let them talk to me and then I do it. And I'm like, I need someone to do that for me. So that's what I spoke to Corey Shark about. And she was very helpful and basically reoriented me to do more of what my friends had suggested, which is paring down. So she really helped me to do what you guys were discussing, which is have a skeletal frame and then add little bits of like character development. And I think the major work I did was just cut and make it a little bit punchier, if that makes sense. And I think the "and Tash" was that punchy bit that worked out well. That actually was originally at the end of that paragraph. And then I was told, make that its own line. And I can see very clearly that worked because it did deliver, you know.
Well, shout out to your friend who said to start with the kiss.
Yeah, shout out to Ivan, the Victoria, or Sarah. I kind of forget which one it was.
Yeah, but you started with a kiss about Tash, but then you ended with Aunt Tash. And so it was like a nice little bookend. It felt very inciting event. All this happens and there's still feelings there. There's still things there. So that's what was genius about the query, in my opinion.
And you just focused so well. Like it gave you like an emotional aesthetic thing to just like, yes, look at this exact moment. And then the rest was focused through that lens and it was great.
Thank you. I realize also for the purposes of this recording that like Manuscript Academy literally offers these sessions. I wasn't aware of that when originally back in October I sent. So I know Curry Sharp doesn't work for Manuscript Academy, but this is why I think the whole meetings with agents that you guys offer is so fantastic because it's like, this is a teacher who can help you with every section of it. So yeah, that's awesome. That's offered.
Yeah. Well, we're big believers in conversation versus form letters. Because what are you going to get from a form letter? And not everyone has a friend to tell you to start with a kiss.
Yeah, those are great friends.
All right, on to the page.
Great. I first saw him on the day of the great train riot, right before my car flew off the rails and smashed into the public gardens below. For the few seconds I sailed through the air, the sky and trees, a swirl of tumbling colors, I wondered if my own house had planted the bomb. For all I knew, it had been built in my very own domicile. My cousin Tiro had spoken of trains only a moon before the riot. That was probably when he had conceived the whole idea, but I didn't know that at the time. It is true, my house is one of the most powerful in Citadel 295 and shoulder deep in the terrorist group, Ka Hess. But I'm also a femme, so trust me when I say I knew nothing. Heshti femmes live in corners. We fold ourselves down neatly like the cloth we weave. We draw the shadows over us like blankets and smother our mouths. The night Tiro talked of trains, I had bandaged my mouth. It made me look like a dutiful Heshti femme to stand against the wall with the cloth wound around the bottom half of my face. It tied at the back of my head and fell in graceful folds around my neck. We're only required to wear the bandages around the other creatures of our world. Our own mouths are allowed to hear us speak and see our colors. But ever since I'd gone through the change several years earlier and been given my bandage as a sign of both modesty and mateability, I'd often chosen to wear it, even among other Heshti. Under my bandage, I can sneer and guffaw, laugh and growl, whisper to myself and hiss warnings or insults. Above the bandage, my eyes remain passive yellow pools. I say very little out loud, but am talking constantly in my head.
Wow.
And this was the page that Melissa chose at our panel.
Yeah. So this is incredibly grounding. So all the things that we talked about in that first query letter that we felt were really interesting, but like too much, you have it all here in this way of we understand who the character is. We understand some of her stakes. The first line was amazing. So good. Like instantly we know we're in like this world that's different. The last line, it's perfect.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about version one of this page? And do you happen to have that too?
This is version one.
Wow.
So the story of this book is that it kind of just sort of came together. And I kept telling my friends that it literally poured out of me. Like I felt such a drive. And with other works I've had writer's block. And this one, it was like I had it in my head and it was just coming out and it was coming out and it was coming out. And so it didn't actually go through any changes. And I think that like when a writer starts a book and the first part comes out well, it's unusual for me, right? Like usually I write the first 10 pages and I'm like, yeah, whatever, that's kind of a mess. Mm-hmm. And then I keep going. But for this one, it like was written and then I'm like, all right, I have to keep going. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry, there's not a version one.
Wow.
Well, do you think that because I think this is really interesting because I think when you really know your material, you've been talking about this, you've teaching a class on it, you have all the students' stories in your head, and then a story starts knocking around. And the story is knocking around, and it's knocking around to the point where it's filling you. And it's kind of there. And like when you have a story that's so much in you, I think you can sometimes access it like this. Some of the things I can't believe you did on a first draft is that first line. And then at the end of that page, so perfectly hit like her thoughts that were so busy, even though her eyes were still. Like that is so interesting. And it's unusual. And I think the unusual nature of it, and I think the voice you have here is really different, uniquely your own. It's fascinating you got those two pieces as a first draft.
Thank you. I mean, I think the fact that it ended there is just literally, that's where the page ended, but it does work.
Well, but no, but I mean, I always say that you should do that. If you're going to a conference or something like that, make sure you pull that last page and you make them want to turn the page.
Well, it's actually, that's kind of what I've been sending is that first page, because I do think it works really well, but like it ended there and I was like, oh, that works. And I kept it, you know, so it was a little bit of luck. But the first line was in, this is going to sound so weird, but this is very much like a Reddit thing, you know, Reddit shower thoughts. When you're in the shower, you're like, seriously, the ideas were knocking on my brain. I even like, this is so nerdy and you don't have to show this, but like I drew a concept art of it because I'm an artist. And so I like it was,
it's beautiful. Right? You just drew that.
Yeah.
Wait, are the eyes somewhere?
Do? No.
You drew the eyes too?
I drew everything. Yeah. This is colored pencil art. And so this is Sarah. And she was like, she was so alive in my brain. And so the way that she looks and everything was just like, she lives in my brain. And I find it sometimes useful to like physically reproduce what is in my brain because it helps me kind of know what they're like. And when I drew her eyes, I felt her in there. Anyway, the first line came to me as a shower thought. I was like, oh, like this is how it's going to begin. So I think sometimes like when there's a concept that you have, I didn't want to force the beginning. It just kind of came and then it, I don't know if other people would find it useful to do concept art, but I do.
Wow. Well, they say that there's a relationship between when you draw and your creative self. How much do you think about female voice and the importance of it?
I'm so glad you asked that question because that was like a main thing in my mind. So I think that there's something that I struggle with a little bit with female voice in a lot of novels, especially in YA novels. Like in a lot of YA novels, there's like this spunky, rebellious girl. And that's some of my students. But a lot of my students have this immensely quiet strength. And it's like, there's something deeply feminine about this, right? In a society where, you know, we're often silenced, even now, the building of that quiet strength, that's to me more reserves of power than the, you know, rebel, pirate, thief person that's often in a YA book. And so I am a very extroverted person and I have a very quick temper and I didn't want to write myself. In fact, I wrote this, so my best friends are, I don't know why, but all my best friends are these introverted women who are like brilliant, wonderful, thoughtful, like the quiet, powerful type. And I basically accessed everything that I found so admirable about them in my character. And it was a unique experience because I wasn't writing myself. But I think that I wanted to tell the story more of a female character who handles oppression in a different way, right? Finds ways within an oppressive model to make it work for them and to subvert things in different ways. And I think more importantly, like my character has just incredible compassion. So there are all sorts of very oppressive systems in her world. And she focuses very deeply on finding like, what is the nature of that oppression? Like, why does that exist? Instead of being like, they're just an evil character and they just do this because they want to take you over. No, there's a lot that's also wrong with the masculine structures of the world. And so, you know, she's not wanting to kill all the men. Like it's this question of what are the very complicated threads in the society? It needs a quiet, powerful mind to pull them apart. And so I wanted more of a female character who didn't talk much, you know, who talked in her head, right? And whose first reaction to something was not burn it down, you know, rebellion, and also wasn't, oh no, I just want to be quiet, right? Like was a sort of a different type of personality that I don't see represented enough, I think, in like pop culture either.
Right.
And I always love, man, I freaking love Princess Leia. Dang, Princess Leia is great. Because Princess Leia has this like nurturing, compassionate aspect And, you know, she's not burning the world down. She's got this diplomatic aspect. But she's also beautiful and she's also cool. And I just feel this lack of that. And so I was trying to have this medium character between that. And so the book is very much a celebration of like all aspects of femininity.
I also liked the moment in your query when you said that people were starting to realize it wasn't a good system for men either. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So one of the things that we talk about so extensively in my gender studies class is that it's a little bit like lazy feminism to like blame everything on patriarchal structures, because the patriarchal structures hurt men as well. And I think that like our culture is having a more of a conversation about the damage that toxic masculinity does to men. And as a teacher of many male identifying students, like I love them, you know, like I feel no more strongly towards, you know, any of my students, no matter how they identify. But I think that there certainly needs to be much more of a recognition of how deeply the patriarchal structures and toxic masculinity hurts men, and how that's okay to recognize, you know, and that a realignment of the system is something that will assist everybody. And I think that the book kind of plays around with this, like not a spoiler, but the matriarchal revolution isn't the answer. You know, in the book, it's not like, we'll just replace the patriarchy with a matriarchy. So I don't have any like evil characters in the book, right? Everybody is doing something because they believe that it is necessary or it's good. And as a historian, that's how history works, right? Unless you're a complete sociopath, in general, people moralize things and justify things to themselves and are harmed by the same oppressive structure that they are using to harm others. So the book is very much also, the male characters are a huge part of the book, and they're not the bad guys, right? Like they are also very much struggling with the systems that are oppressing everybody else.
That's nice, because it's like you mirror how complex it is. It's not an easy swap this with that. It's really complicated for everybody.
Which I think, right. And you did initially comp The Handmaid's Tale, and I see why you went to more YA, but you can see some of the nods there, because you do see that. You do see that there's a lot of levels. Every person has their needs and their wants, and it all gets mucked up in a system. And how they all shoot out of that, the other side, is really what makes the story.
Thanks.
Yeah. I saw a discussion on Reddit that was like, do we really have to say the patriarchy's bad for men to get it to change anything? And it's, I see the annoyance, but what if it works?
Especially, I think, for our young men, right? You know, I think there's this idea of they're all caught up in a system. I teach teenage boys, and there's a lot of space for change there, you know? And I mean, also the book goes into a lot of just the question of gender expression in general. And that was the fun of using fantasy species, is that I didn't use like elves and witches. I just invented them all. And they came clearly into my brain. And the whole purpose of doing that is that like the different civilizations that she comes in contact with and different species handle gender and social structures and power structures very differently. And it's sort of, I don't know if you've met, this is an adult book, but Becky Chambers' sci-fi does a lot of that, where she's like, here is a species that their gender changes every 10 years, or like their structure is open marriage, open sex, and this is how the society results from that. And I was very inspired by that to think about using other species and fantasy creatures to look at, okay, so what if society was structured this way or this way, you know, and like to open like dialogue about it, because when we are frightened of it and we make it a political issue, then it's not helpful. But like when there's creative dialogue around it, I think it can be very cool.
So is there anything we can help you with? Because it sounds like you're in a really good spot.
I'm very much in love with my book, as all writers are, right? And it hurts deeply when I get the rejections. And so I just want to like, you know, I think I'd want to tell everybody else who's listening to this, like, maybe they're like, oh, wow, their agents have nothing but nice things to say. Ouch, the rejections are hurting so much. And it's like, wait a second, you know, I'm getting some good responses here, but it's not as though, you know, I'm getting like, oh my goodness, send this to me immediately. So I think there's so much of like, don't take it personally, but I think it's tough not to take it personally.
It's tough. It's tough. Marlo Garnsworthy, she's an editor and a writer, and she wrote a great blog post about rejection. And it's just all about how the more you go through it, you learn grit and determination and all these things, because it's not normal to go through this much pain. You know, it's just not. I mean, if I have any advice, is can you take that pain and give yourself a reward? Like, oh my gosh, look at me. I actually had the guts to put out 5 queries. That's guts. Like, what do you do for yourself by having guts and determination? Like, maybe you go out for an ice cream. Maybe you have a glass of wine in the garden. Maybe you just take a moment with the sun on your face. And you say, I'm doing something. Like, I don't really have any doubt that this is going to find a home. I really don't. Like, I think it's just as meant to be in the world. From what I've seen, it looks really terrific, the shape it's in right now. You have mentors that are, you know, knowledgeable and there for you. So you have your people. I think you're close.
Thank you. I think I have also a question that might help other people who might be struggling with this, which is the genre question, because originally this was kind of anthropological fiction in the style of like Becky Chambers, but Becky Chambers still has sort of the spaceships and stuff. And then I actually like reworked it to be fantasy, but with imagined species. And I'm having difficulty sort of in two ways. First of all, sort of explaining to agents that it's fantasy, but it's not like elves and whatnot. It's more sort of an imagined creatures. And there's also an imagined scientific system that makes everything work. I was pre-med in college, and that was like my other life was like going that way. So there's a lot of like biological underpinnings to the different species and stuff. So it's like more, there's an alternate science space. It's not real science, but like it's got some science in it that makes it a little bit not the sort of usual fantasy, like everything's happening because of magic, right? There is magic, but it's more science. So I'm struggling to kind of get that across. It's a little bit of a genre blend. And then the other problem I'm having is that this was written for my high schoolers, but it's not in the usual like YA style, right? It is kind of more adult. I wrote it essentially to be read by, you know, high school students, but also kind of beyond, especially like Gen Z, you know, who are the ones that I think are getting like pummeled by these culture wars. But I don't know if it would be advisable to also pitch to adult audiences or how to alter the query to do that. Or like, yes, those are my questions.
Okay. So I had a thought just start to emerge while you were speaking, and I'm still working on this, but I wonder if it's true that fictional science counts as magic toward fantasy. I think it does. Because if you're inventing science in your fictional world that drives your fictional world that also has magic, I think that is another point for it to be in the fantasy genre. So I need to think about that some more, because I could see how if it was done in one way, it'd be sci-fi, and another way, it'd be fantasy. But I think you can comfortably call this fantasy from what you've described. And you don't have to say, by the way, no dragons, because that's just one kind of fantasy.
The only thing I think of that sort of does a similar thing is, you know how Patrick Rothfuss has the whole scientific system that underpins the way his magic works?
Oh.
It's kind of like that. So
I think that's fine. I don't think anyone's going to be like, well, please tell me the mechanics in the query letter so I can decide if it's exactly the gradation of fantasy I can stand. No, they want to know by just reading the pages. In terms of, how old are your characters? They're late teens?
Yeah, she was actually originally like 20. And then okay. I lowered it to 17, which didn't make much of a difference. But yeah, she's 17.
So yeah, I mean, in theory, you could find more agents who work on adult fantasy, and you could pitch it as fantasy to them and pitch it as YA fantasy to YA agents. I mean, you can definitely have adult fantasy with younger characters, or you could do a finer place and make her 20 again. Either way, I think would open up more agents for you. You just have to, in your chart for your submissions, keep track of what you told each agent it was.
And so for doing that, is there a need to change the existing query letter to make it sound more adult?
No, I don't think so.
I guess I would just change your age.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's basically all of the questions that I have. I paused on submitting till I had this discussion with you guys in case you were like, you need to change this thing big time. Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. Actually, you need to set it 100 years in the future. And
I was very much open to hearing, because, you know, the whole process about this writing is that I want to be open to feedback and change as long as it doesn't compromise, you know, the main drive of the narrative. But I think I'm going to start querying again. I like the idea of ice cream.
Just a little treat. And I would say it, I think we have agents that are listening. So if you're an agent and you're listening and you're like, I would like to request this, you know, you can.
Where can they find you?
I do have a website. I have a website. It is alliemclafferty.com. And it's all one word, just alimclafferty.com. So it's alimclafferty.com. And that has my contact information.
And we certainly hope you'll let us know if somebody reaches out to you and says that they heard you on the podcast and want to read more.
We love good news. We love it.
What was it like when you heard your page read and Melissa chose you?
Well, my children were getting ready for their bath. And so they were calling for me and I was paying attention. And I want to say that when my page came up, I almost left the room. Like, in fact, I almost left the session before my page came up because the other authors were so brave and having their stuff being read out. And I was like, I don't think I'm brave enough to do this right now. And so I almost left the session and then didn't. And then Melissa pulled up the page and then you read it and you read it like so beautifully. And I was like, oh, this sounds good being read this way. And then there was a pause and I was like, I had sort of held the table bracing myself because you had given wonderful feedback to the other authors. But also, you know, I was ready for any kind of critiques that were negative or positive. And when you guys really liked it, I may have started to cry a tiny bit. Just like, not like big tears, but you know, when your eyes get a little prickly because it had been rejected, you know, and I was like, I was starting to be like, should I do this? Because I was just getting some form rejections and I'm like, oh, I don't think anyone's even interested in the concept. So it was extremely powerful validation for me. So I got a little bit weepy and then I ran into the bathroom where my children were being bathed. And I said to my husband, oh my God. La, la. And so it felt so wonderful. And I just really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking the time out of your day to read all of our submissions and to read mine so beautifully and so thoughtfully. And you've been so kind. And I know the whole idea of the Manuscript Academy is this kindness, but it is so wonderful because that's like the best kind of teaching and validation. And to have this opportunity has been wonderful. And even if this doesn't go anywhere, I want to deeply thank you so much for your time and for your confidence in what I gave you. Thank you so much.
You made my day. Thank you.
What is one message you would give to all the writers out there?
The advice I'd give as someone who loves doing this and has not had any luck, this is lucky. I think that you're a writer because you write. And that if that's this thing that gives you joy, even when it's a pain, I don't think it matters if it ever goes anywhere. There's something so deep inside of us that wants us to tell a story. And I think the joy of it is like the writing of it, not the pitching and whatever else, right? So I think that, for example, if this book that I deeply believe in, it never gets picked up, like I'm still going to write because I think that we're writers because some entity, right? Like the whole word genius, I think, comes from this like Latin of like a little genie that floats around you and gives you ideas. That is something that is deeply a part of us. And so I just want us all to keep writing because when I was on the Manuscript Academy and I read people's writing, I'm like, dang, this is so cool. And it can be so painful to have it be rejected and to think that maybe it won't ever go anywhere, but it doesn't, you're a writer, not because you're published, you're a writer because you write.
Agreed. I mean, it's, and that's, I think, so important for everyone out there. And it is a journey. Like it's a rare story. We podcasted the other day with someone and they're like, they made it sound so easy, but once you unpacked, it was years, you know? And it's just, you have to keep putting both feet forward, keep those fingers on the keys. And just like we say to students, right? Did you try? What did you learn from the process? What are you going to do next time? You know, it's teaching and writing. If we can say to ourselves what we say to other people, like it would be so kinder to ourselves, you know?
And I think you're right. Like it is, we're teaching ourselves and learning. Like I tell my 12th graders when they leave to try to read a paper that they wrote in ninth grade. And they're always like, oh my God, I was so stupid. You had started to write. And then we taught you these skills, you know? And I think that, you know, the more we write, the more we're like learning this really cool craft. I'd love to read J.K. Rowling's first teenage draft of something and be like, that sucks. Feel better that now her works are like,
mwah. That's so funny.
Well, gosh, I guess this is kind of a shot in the dark, but you are so good at telling stories. Do you have a fun story of something that has happened with your writing?
Ooh, okay. It's actually not this book. It's a different one. So the first book that I wrote, I loved doing it, but it was so much learning the process, you know, and then looking back on it, like there are some parts that I'm like, that's really great. And others that drag. But the ending, I thought I did very well. And my husband read the book and my husband is like a very lovely, compassionate, wonderful person. And he's going to listen to this. And he's going to be like, Ali, why did you say this? But anyway, he cries a lot at sappy things. And so like sappy commercials, the man will start to like get a little weepy. If there's a commercial with a puppy, my husband will start to get weepy.
Yeah, mine too.
And isn't it great? Every time it happens, I'm like, God, I love you so much. Thank you for being so beautifully fragile and yet so strong. And at the Super Bowl, when they did this whole, my husband loves football, when they did this whole, you know, backstory about the guy, whatever his name is, Brock Purdy, and how he was like the last draft pick, and then he's winning the Super Bowl, which is maybe an analogy for writing. I don't even know. And my husband comes to the kitchen where I'm making stuff for the Super Bowl party. And he's like, Allie, this story is so inspiring. And I'm like, oh man, are you crying over football again? Anyway, my husband read the first book and he came inside after he'd been reading and he was like crying quite openly. And I was like, oh, did you get a bee sting? And he was like, no, I read that last part of your book. And that was like really moving. And I was like, oh, wow. Thank you. And my husband, as I said, I mean, he cries easily. So it's not like the last part of my book was like, you know, it cracked a stone, but it elicited this emotion from somebody who I love very much. And it was real. And I think that was like this moment of, oh, wow, something I wrote like really touched somebody in that way. Somebody that I love and I care very much about what he thinks. And he's not one to just like manufacture crocodile tears to make his writer wife feel happy. So, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, may all of you out there make your loved ones cry with your book.
Or laugh.
Ali, I'm so happy we got to do this. This was such just a wonderful window into a writer's life. And we're just so optimistic for you. We can't wait to hear what happens for you next. I was so happy that your students were happy for you too. That was such a nice story.
I can't wait to tell them that I had a really fun time at the podcast.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
Such a deep right. pleasure to speak with you both. Thank you all so right. much for your time and help.
Thank you.
Bye now. We are so glad that you joined us. And as always, we appreciate your feedback. Just head on over to the iTunes store and let us know what you think. It not only helps us make this podcast be the best it can be, but it also affects our ratings within the iTunes platform.
We'd love to hear from you. If you're feeling brave and want to submit your page for our First Pages podcast, you can send it to academy@manuscriptwishlist.com with First Pages podcast in the subject line. We'd also just love to hear from you.
And if you'd like to learn more about the Manuscript Academy and everything we have to offer, just jump on over to manuscriptacademy.com.